Thanks for pinch hitting today.
Yep. Back to the old days there, Kim.
Yeah.
Right.
So good morning, everyone. And thank you, Kim. And as always, the CROG for hosting our Zoom abilities for the ACIR. This is the Advisory Commission of on Intergovernmental Relations Subcommittee on Local Government of the Future. This is our regularly scheduled meeting for Tuesday, the 22nd. I'm Brendan Sharkey, the chairman of the ACIR, and we've got our vice chair, Lyle Ray, with us as well. I don't know if, Lyle, you wanted to add a word?
Nope. At some point, I do want to reflect my conversation with Representative Vahey on the local government of the future. So at some point later on, I'll make a comment.
Great. Okay. Yeah. I was just talking with her on Friday about our other reports that they're ruminating over. So we can have a little time to talk about that today. So again, this is you all know the protocols for the Zoom meeting. If you wish to be recognized, raise your hand electronically or visually, and I'll recognize you for that purpose. Otherwise, if you can stay muted, we'd appreciate that to avoid background noise. I'm going to skip over to item two. We have notes from our last month's meeting. I don't know if anybody, I'm skipping over it, but if anyone had any thoughts on those meeting notes, which are not technically minutes, happy to entertain those thoughts, but assuming there are none, I'm going to run right to the topic of the day, which is, a discussion about the, Intergovernmental Emergency Management System issues. This is a topic, I'll just preface this briefly by letting folks know this was a topic that was brought to us by Jim O'Leary, who I think felt that there might be an opportunity for the ACIR to look into this question and perhaps take it on as a study topic. I think it's something that since Jim raised it, I think folks have weighed in a little bit with their thoughts. And it's to be determined, I think, by this group as to whether or not this is something that we want to take up within ACIR as something to study. And we can talk a little bit more about the different recommendations I think folks have offered and hear from members who are attending today. But what I'll do at first, if you could just kind of give us a brief summary of your perspective on the issue and where you think we are in a succinct way, and then we can kind of go from there.
Sure. Okay. Thank you. And good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
The first point I think I would make is that, this is our Commission on Intergovernmental Relations, and what we're talking about here, what I'm looking at would be the intergovernmental relations that are really related to emergency management during a crisis. So it really is intergovernmental relations. It's the relationship for us mostly to focus on is the relationship between state agencies and municipalities in terms of communication and the management of the flow of information between state agencies, the governor's office, and the municipal leadership. So from my view, it is a very much of an intergovernmental topic, so to speak. And so I would start with that. The second thing that I would want to say is that this conversation that I would like to have would focus on from now going forward, how to ensure that there is the proper structure and flow of information from state agencies and the governor's office to the municipalities, and vice versa, from municipalities back up to the appropriate state leadership positions. So it's the flow of information that we're really looking at here. I think we have, there's probably lessons to be learned from the pandemic emergency, but I think probably there's really no benefit in looking back. I think this is really a topic for the future, and in terms of ensuring that that the structure that has been mandated by the federal government, also mandated by the governors, including Governor Lamont. So, you know, the National Incident Management System has been mandated to state agencies and municipalities by Governor Rell, by Governor Malloy, and by Governor Lamont. They've all signed the documents that put that system in place. So what I would like to focus on is how we can assist all of these parts of this structure, how we can assist these parts to come to a more perfect understanding of what their relationship is and how they work together most effectively. All of this is spelled out in documents that have been promulgated to the various agencies by the governor. And all of the documents are very much, I think, in public circulation. The next thing I would say is that I had thought at the beginning of when I was thinking about this that maybe a solution and one of the things that ACIR could be involved with has to do with maybe there should be some legislation proposed that would more clearly spell out this mandate for the state agencies. But in my conversation with Deputy Commissioner Brenda Bergeron on Friday, she pointed out that legislation already exists, and she sent me a copy of it. I forwarded that. I guess I didn't forward that particular document, but there is a Connecticut statute 28-5 parentheses E, actually addresses this issue and spells it out very clearly what the relationship is supposed to be. So I think what we probably could focus on is not have to worry about legislation, but just focus on how best to, you might say, provide the best possible dialogue between the state agencies and municipalities. And pretty much that's what the document that I sent out to, I guess I sent it to a few of you this morning. Brenda sent it to me on Friday. I can send it to everybody, but it's this state training and exercise plan, which was signed off by the commissioners on 10/24/19. 2019, so just before the pandemic. So I think there has been an awareness right along that state agencies have had some difficulty complying with this mandate, I guess you would say. And so there was an effort being made after about a year of Governor Lamont being in office to try to provide more training and provide a structure for how the state agencies were supposed to approach this mandate. So I think that's where what I would like to focus on, to see if there is a way that ACAR, in its role as an intergovernmental mediator, so to speak, could help all of the parties concerned to reach a common agreement as to the path to follow forward. That's what I would say.
Okay. Thanks, Jim. Margaret, before I recognize you, let me just ask. So what, if Jim, if you could kind of explain to the group what you think the problem is that ACIR can help solve.
Sure. The problem is that the mandated system that the state has been training and exercising for, well, intensively since 9/11, so for more than 20 years, that mandated system of the National Incident Management System requires a certain structure that should be established during an emergency. And the state has adopted that as mandated by the federal government, and municipalities have adopted that. So municipalities have been training and exercising this plan, and I would say most municipalities are on board and adhere to the plan. But the state agencies have had a reluctance to really buy into this, I think. I'm not sure why, but under Governor Malloy and under the first year for Governor Lamont, it became apparent that state agencies, I guess I would say the leadership in the state agencies, the senior people in those agencies who've been with the agencies for years, they have been reluctant, I think, to want to do the training and to want to put in the time that's necessary to learn how this system works. So that's why the state Division of Emergency Management was beginning this effort in January of 2019 to try to develop awareness and to provide a syllabus for training for the state agencies. So the issue is that during the last several years, this process does not appear to have been followed. If it were being followed, it was imperfectly followed. And so there's improvement needed in how this process is used, because without it, it leads to great confusion at the local level. I'd say that's what the problem is.
Okay, great. All right. Margaret, yeah. You had your hand up?
Yes, I do. This is not the first time I think ACIR has run up against things like this. And I remember so many times that we always said, well, we have it here. It's in the legislation, and then it can't get implemented because nobody realized that there are other actors. For example, like I believe Troy is from the unions and things like that. No one really was able to figure out whose legal rights come first. And it's, you know, to implement something like that, I think that everybody has to be at the table.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Brandon, if I may, I would point out that Deputy Commissioner Bergeron would have liked to have been here today, but she had a conflict, so she could not attend. But she said she would be available to come to another subcommittee meeting if we have one on this topic.
Well, that was going to be my other question. I know, you know, you and I had spoken, I think on Friday morning, and you had said that you were going to be talking to the deputy commissioner. What is her view of the problem that you're identifying?
I think I can't speak for her. I wouldn't want to do that. But I will tell you that she described the document that I sent to you to a number of you this morning as aspirational. In her view, it's not a done deal, and it's not. You know, I don't want to phrase this in a way that sounds like anybody has been an obstructionist to this. But I don't believe that's the case. I believe it's simply the case that state agencies are busy. State agency heads are busy. There's training and there's work involved in understanding. I mean, if you just start to look at the documents that are involved, there's a lot of work involved here. And with our turnover at the state agency level at this point, it's particularly a difficult time to encourage the leadership of those agencies to actually pay attention to this, because one of the reasons is because this information is probably only useful to them. Who knows? Maybe once a year, once every two or three years. It all depends on the emergencies that come along. But when it happens, it's vitally important, critical, that they are aware of this and understand how it works, and that they've participated in the exercises that the Division of Emergency Management is charged with providing. So it's not something that we want to take on as anything adversarial to these agencies or to anybody, to the governor's staff or anything like that. It's just something that needs to happen somehow or another. But it's been very difficult just because Governor Rell issued what was her executive order number 10 didn't mean that it happened. There were still lots of folks in state agencies back then who pretty much ignored the mandate. And I think the same has been true, and it's more true now with the turnover. It's a really important time that all of us involved in intergovernmental relations should really put an emphasis on this, because it is vitally important during an emergency.
Okay. All right. Thanks. So are there any other comments about Jim's, John, and then I let me defer to the vice chair, if I may.
I'll be very quick. I'd be supportive of having Brenda Bergeron come and have a conversation with us before we commit to much, to invite her to our next meeting to have a conversation about what the problem is. I did reach out to my emergency management director, and we do a lot of this in the Capital Region. We have a very robust process, and they weren't clear what the problem was. So maybe with the new information, we could get it. But I would encourage us to hear from Brenda Bergeron. The other impression I have is this is a inside the executive branch issue. There's a lot of coordination inside the executive branch that might be improved, but intergovernmental is, I think, among layers. It's not inside the executive branch. So I guess two quick points is I suggest we have Brenda Bergeron come and speak to us, and then see what the nature of the problem is and whether it fits the multi-layer government problem. I got lots of those for you. But that's my two cents worth. John, I'm sorry.
Yeah, John. Thanks, Lyle. Yeah. John?
I would agree with Lyle. I think it's important to get Brenda in because she is an expert and lived the response at the highest level to the pandemic, because I'm really scratching my head to figure out the problem that Jim is identifying as a problem. Just myself sitting through those meetings and the amount of communication, I thought, to the local officials in particular, you know, depending on the intensity of the pandemic, the briefings were not less than weekly to first selectmen and CEOs, and there were hundreds of folks on those calls. And then at various tiers, I mean, so it was not only a unique event, but a robust response, I thought. So I guess before I get too much into it, I would defer to, I think it would be important to listen to Brenda. I think, you know, one of my things is not so much looking back at a critique of whether we followed NIMS perfectly or not, or everybody was informed, is some of the structural issues going forward that on an intergovernmental basis that I observe, just a couple of them. We have the DEMIS regions, which were fundamental to this. They don't align well with the COG regions, which is a problem. The 73 health departments don't align and have various capacities to respond. Those were both weaknesses. The regional education service centers, being six other regions, you know, we go back to that group of maps that we produced years ago where everything doesn't align up, and it's coming back to haunt us again. And I think if those were some of the things, now looking at recovery, the workforce boards and the EDDs don't necessarily all align up as well. And some of those alignments and relationships to the state, I think going forward, is something we could be helpful in looking at.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know that Martin Heft is not on the, in the meeting right now. But I feel like I should at least reflect a little bit of what I think he's communicated to me anyway, which is that, and I'll let him speak for himself in more detail to the extent that he can, but, and I've mentioned this to Jim as well, that I think there's some reticence within OPM about ACIR taking on a topic that may be more, while it does have impacts on intergovernmental relations, that it really is fundamentally an executive branch issue as to whether the executive branch members are adequately taking part in the system. And that there may be some, I'm paraphrasing, but there may be some inappropriateness for the ACIR to be diving into a topic that involves study and involves really studying the executive branch as to how they, in fact, are carrying out a statutory requirement among themselves. So that was a little bit of the discomfort that I think was coming out of OPM. That being said, I think John's making a good point, which is that to the extent that there is that this may be the result of, you know, a mismatch of regions and functionality on a regional basis among different categories of services, that this is just a further manifestation of that. You know, that may certainly be a topic for discussion for ACIR to take on. I know I'd love to do that, but in any case, I think that's where Martin was coming from in terms of as a participant in and a member of ACIR as to whether or not that should be a role that we take on. But having that also is a, you know, it's been raised by Lyle and John that maybe we should hear from Brenda directly and kind of get her take on the extent to which she perceives there's a problem and whether ACIR can be helpful. I don't know if you have any other thoughts on that, on what John and Lyle offered. Jim?
Yeah, well, I would agree with John to the issues that he raised. And I would also say that in terms of what Brenda would say, you know, I don't believe that that she would be trying to point to this being a problem at the executive level of government. My intention right along has been that this shouldn't be addressed as a problem. This should be addressed as we want to enhance how the state agencies and municipalities communicate together, that we should, you know, learn from the past, but that we shouldn't approach this as having been a problem during the pandemic, because one way or another, I think the governor did a fine job, and the governor and his staff and the agencies did a fine job as we moved through the pandemic. But the National Incident Management Plan, if it had been adhered to, if it had been better understood, I think, by the participants, by the state agencies, and to some extent by the municipalities, if it could have been better understood and some of the key points of that, it could have, I think, helped the governor and the agencies get through the pandemic. And so going forward, I think that that would just be a lesson learned, and that all of our efforts should be not on, as I say, not on being critical or trying to point out deficiencies, but simply to say, just as this document says, that this is, that moving, in other words, I wouldn't address it as being a problem. I would address it as being some intergovernmental relations that need to be that need to be discussed and trained and exercised, and that ACIR could, because I believe that state agencies are having a difficult time with this because of the training involved and because of the turnover, I think it would just be a good opportunity for ACIR to, you might say, enhance the governor's effort.
But so Jim, if I could, just let me ask you, so what would you, if you were making a recommendation, what would you propose that the ACIR do? Because on the one hand, it sounds like maybe ACIR can play a role in terms of advocating that the system that Brenda provided to you, and you've disseminated out to a few of us anyway, for that plan that was adopted in 2019, you know, that maybe we can just make a statement virtually that, you know, that ACIR recommends that plan be actually carried out and implemented.
Okay. Right there, Brendan, I would say, yes, I think that would be helpful. And then I think if at that point the executive branch felt like they wanted some further encouragement, you might say, from ACIR, that would be fine. We could lend a hand. But I think just the notion that we recommend that they follow these documents that have all been prepared and signed off by the governor would be an important step forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay. As opposed to, you know, this being something that ACIR takes on as a study and, you know, starts interviewing people to see what works and what, I mean, I'm not sure there's a comfort with doing something like that.
And I would say working, identifying perhaps some areas that John was talking about, because they surely are major stumbling blocks in terms of how this information flows. So, you know, there are pieces of this that we could perhaps address.
Yeah.
But the main thing, and I've said it right along, is that this can't go anywhere in an adversary. I don't believe it can go anywhere in an adversarial manner. It has to be something that is done in order to assist the executive branch to do this training and get the word out that this is the plan that needs to be followed so right. that everybody is trained and exercised in that plan.
Right. Okay. John?
I just want to be very careful in that which I don't agree with, and we want people to follow the law, but I don't want to also be associated with an assumption that it was not followed.
No.
I think I would wait and listen to the deputy commissioner and see if there actually is an issue, because for the life of me, I just don't see that that's a proper assumption that the key agencies were either unaware, deficient, whatever the issue might be in the use of NIMS or in their response to COVID and their relation to the governor. I think that's a fairly large leap and not one that we should take lightly or assume. And so I'd like to listen to her before we really have too much discussion back and forth and we end up almost getting into a debate. Well, we could have done this better or that better. That gets into the almost an investigation level, which is not what we should be doing. So I'm more and more uncomfortable, I guess, with it, unless there's something truly apparent that was not done. And I'm not aware that there was. I don't know what the training was, because, whatever an agency has, it has. But I don't have that information sitting here. So I don't want to make that assumption that somehow they could have done better. So
okay.
I think let's listen to the deputy.
Lyle, you're muted.
I got to get my unmuted t-shirt. Not to prolong this, I would support having Deputy Commissioner Bergeron come and have a conversation with us, and maybe Jim can ask her some questions. I think that would be very helpful. The other thing that's in the NIMS vocabulary is after action analysis. And this is something we may want to think about asking them to do. We've had a regional emergency management system before the governor mandated it. In fact, we had it a year before Governor Rell mandated it in this region. So we've had one for a very long time. We think it works pretty well. So I don't want to be associated with tarring our group, which we think, I think functions well. But something part of their vocabulary is an after-action analysis. In other words, how did COVID-19 response go? What can we learn? And they're very common. They do very frequent after-action analysis in that world. So that's something just to bear at the back of our mind, is something that they could do in terms of a self-analysis of what could be done better, because they do it all the time. So I guess to put it simply, I would suggest that we invite the deputy commissioner along, have a conversation, see where we are. But one thing that might be constructive, and I agree with everything John said, but would be to, ask for them to do an after-action analysis. Let's see what worked and what they would suggest be better done next time. So.
Right, right. Okay. So I think the suggestion is that we schedule the deputy commissioner to come visit and give us some information at our next subcommittee meeting, I'm assuming. Next month, if that's okay with you, Jim. That sounds like
that sounds fine. And when that date is
that would be the 22nd of March.
Okay. I will send an email to Deputy Commissioner Bergeron and ask her if she could be available at 10:30, and we could get her point of view.
Great.
I think Lyle's point about the after action report would be excellent, and maybe if we if the Division of Emergency Management would conduct that after action report, then that would provide some basis for if there is a problem, what should be done, or a basis for analysis of future training. And again, I think John, if you read the document that Brenda sent on Friday, in her view, being as how this was aspirational, I think if we look up the word aspirational, we'll see some meaning there.
Okay. All right, good. Well, that'll be our plan for next month's subcommittee meeting. Thanks, Jim, for bringing this to our attention and for making the connection both in the past and going forward with Commissioner Bergeron, and then we can take it from there, if that makes sense. So then we have on our agenda other topics, if any. Lyle, did you have another item you wanted to bring up in the subcommittee context?
I had a conversation with Representative Vahey on this in the CROG legislative meeting, and I was suggesting that if P&D had items, and this may be redundant with your conversation with her, if you had items that they would like studied for the local government of the future to pass them along to you.
Oh, great.
That was the suggestion, because we brainstormed a lot of things that need work. And I was saying, you know, this is ACIR territory and some of the issues. So not to put words in her mouth, I was going to suggest that you and she have a conversation about this in terms of our future agenda. So that's basically the sum and substance of it.
Yeah, great. Great. Yeah. Actually, my conversation, she called me actually, because she was wondering how best to approach the pending legislation on extending the local meeting, mm-hmm. Remote meeting authorization. So we were discussing that back and forth. And I think she came, I think we should be prepared potentially for, I know I will be, Lyle, maybe you want to be as well, to prepare some testimony in support of the legislation that they propose. I think we concluded that as far as draft legislation goes, the committee should just simply adopt a bill that would lift the deadline for the authorization to do remote meetings and have it lifted indefinitely so that it could be continued. Instead of, I know I told her that several members had expressed concern that if they were to like to extend the April deadline to something, you know, some other arbitrary date, that could really wreak havoc on a lot of different functions at the right. local level. So at the very least, if they were going to do just an extension, that it'd be to a time when the legislature would be in session, so that we wouldn't have to be waiting for months, you know, in this limbo state. She got that. But I think where we ultimately landed was draft legislation that lifts that deadline entirely and allows it to continue on indefinitely. And if there's a reason to rein it in at some point, let's hear it in a public hearing context, but otherwise assume that we're going to go forward.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask a question, we also have our legislative drafter here, John Filchak. Do you think we can get their help to draft that?
It's an easy thing to draft.
I think she's just going to have her LCO drafted that way.
That's what I was saying. Okay, that's fine. Yeah. That's what I was asking. Yeah.
But we should be prepared for is to provide testimony and support at a public hearing whenever that's held.
But you know how it is. I just want to make sure we have a specific bill in front of them. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. That's helpful. And I appreciate the conversation about, other topics. It was, I think, a bit of a burden for us to be taking on a study, not of our own volition, but rather one required of us by the legislature. But I think it was helpful and productive, and I think it also increases the visibility of ACIR and in the minds of the legislature anyway, which I then used, by the way, in my conversation with her as a shameless plug to promote additional staffing at OPM, in part to help us and help Bruce take some of the burden off of our staffing. So Francis and then Margaret.
Yes, thanks, Brandon. While we're on other topics, I just want to throw three out there for consideration for the future.
Before you do, can I just make sure that sure. No one else had a point on that topic before we move on? Margaret, you had your hand raised.
The other topic, I'll just yield to, don't worry about it. I was going to say something nice, that's all.
Okay.
Don't let it happen again, Margaret. No.
So, I'm sorry, Francis.
No problem. So, you know, I think the last couple of years with the unprecedented federal largesse we've been receiving in Connecticut and the rest of the nation and could receive through discretionary grants has really cast into relief the ability of state, regional, local governments to access federal funds. And I don't want to sound like a broken record here, but I think we're at a nice juncture. We could look at, are there process or structural changes we can make to make it easier for us to access federal funds, right? So looking at IIJA, most of these grants have very large prerequisites. There's a lot of work you have to do to get them. You have to have plans. You have to have accomplished grant writers. You have to have a multi-jurisdictional projects. It's not just something dashed off on a Friday afternoon in a town hall before it closes. So we've been talking about regional grant writing. That's kind of creating an instance, but we may also want to look at other things. Say, the state has a lot of grant programs. Do the funding criteria they use complement federal ones? If you get a state grant, are you automatically eligible to match that to a federal grant? Or do we have a Venn diagram that overlaps like this, where we're not actually syncing up our criteria? We saw in the last year, the legislature went to using consistent criteria for small and medium businesses with EDA, I believe, to try to sync things up. So maybe looking at that. And then another one of my hobby horses, I mentioned before, is just the long-term finances of municipalities. We know they vary dramatically in terms of their unfunded liabilities. Why is that? It's not just the fact that some areas have more business or wealthier residents. It's also management, but it's also past choices. We've looked at, for the last 40 years, OPM has collected municipal fiscal indicators on every municipality in Connecticut. And at WestCog, we digitized over 500 pages of printed tables, and we can now look at per capita inflation-adjusted spending in every municipality in Connecticut. And it's really quite interesting. So there may be some data there we can play with, but just how to get more federal money, what operational process and structural changes, and then municipal finances are other topics that I'd be interested in.
Yeah. Well, can I ask you, this kind of goes into a little bit what John was touching on earlier about the mismatch of agencies here in the state. And where I'm going with this is that in my legislative history, when I chaired P&D, I led the charge to create the EDCs, because what was happening when Governor Rell was in office was that we were missing out on federal money.
Yep.
Because we didn't fit the category. First of all, you know, this is the county equivalency issue, I guess, mm-hmm. to a certain degree. And secondly, we didn't have economic development districts here in Connecticut, either on a county level or on any level. And finally, the state economic development apparatus actively discouraged regions in Connecticut from creating their own EDCs to qualify them for federal ED money. I don't mean to get too wonky about it, but I mean, the problem was that city, in this particular case, in terms of economic development money, federal money, cities, large cities could always qualify. and apply directly to the feds. But the problem was that smaller towns or medium-sized towns could not, because they weren't large enough. But you could apply to the feds under an EDC, an economic development district, jointly as a region, and disseminate that money and bring that money back to Connecticut to be disseminated. So therefore, smaller towns could actually start getting federal money for the first time. The administration at the time actively discouraged that. And the legislature, I kind of led the charge to get legislation to require that this be allowed. So I'm very sensitive to that issue and the availability of federal money that we currently leave on the table, either in part because we don't have consolidated regions and regional boundaries and or county equivalents. And so I'm very interested in what you're talking about, as well as the fiscal, we can also get into the fiscal accountability issue as well. I think that's a really interesting thing. And it dovetails nicely with what John was pointing out about, why do all of our regions not align? So that's my soapbox on that. John?
I think what Francis is talking about on the fiscal stuff is really important and something we should take a deeper dive in. It would be interesting. On the 28th, the Revenue Department is supposed to release its first tax incidence study since 2014. And it would be that data coupled with what Francis, which is the first time I've heard of that, which sounds really, really neat stuff. That data, I think, coupled with this larger discussion of how the economic development, I think would be something we should have some focus on, and this disconnect of the regions. When you were in the legislature, the EDDs, we've now seen a disconnect where several of the regions have allowed the COG and the EDD to kind of part ways. So in one situation, the COG and the EDD are fairly close. In another one, they're very far apart. They don't talk, they barely talk to one another. So again, that fractured nature of the state just hurts us. And the other piece of that I would look at is what's lacking in there is the revenue sharing when we do these larger initiatives. We're still too focused on, okay, let's locate a Amazon facility in Bridgeport, forget about all the surrounding communities. We can't be doing that as a state. It's not only revenue sharing, but it's development sharing so that when the state makes an investment, it's just not in that host community, but it's in the neighboring communities as well. So there's a bunch of elements to this that Francis raises that I think warrant further study by this group.
Yeah. Brian?
Thank you. Yeah, I just want to kind of add and follow up on a couple of the things that you said. I don't know if you recall, Mr. Speaker, when we did the overlays with all the different boundaries, it ended up turning black at the end.
Yeah, that was thanks to John. John did.
But I think I'd like to follow up on what Francis said. I think one of the key things is the data that we have out there. A lot of it's already being collected, but no one's actually doing anything with it. And I think, goes back to, one of the things that we're going to be looking at again is trying to get some of our, majority, if not all members to do uniform chart of accounts. I think that's another thing as far as collecting data that will be helpful. We've run into, issues on the Board of Ed side, but not only that, I'll be candid, our own members, a lot of people are like, oh, we use QuickBooks or we use this. We don't want to upgrade our system. We don't want to do that. But I think that's something where if we can bridge that gap, I don't know if it's, monetary, there might be some reluctance to, pay for something that town should be doing anyway. But that I think would be helpful in trying to figure out what we're spending per capita, where we are, and then trying to use best practices out of that.
Right. Brian knows better than most the uniform chart of accounts fight that
yes
that we had, and we got it done. But you're right. to the extent that folks are reticent about, particularly boards of ed, about participating and contributing to that. Yeah, which feeds directly into Francis's point. Do you think that there's a way to articulate this between now and a week from Friday to perhaps present this as a concept for the full ACIR to take on as an LGF initiative? Can we work on that?
Mm-hmm. I'm happy to help. Sure.
Yeah. John, you had your hand raised, I think.
I think there should be, and I, you know, even if it's not perfect, I think we can raise it with the other, with the rest of the group. I'm happy to contribute to it.
Okay, John. John and Francis have both volunteered.
I can help as well.
Careful!
And I raised the tax incident study because I think it's important. Too often we're looking at per capita impacts, which don't tell the full story. If you look at the property tax data from that 2014 study, the burden falls on those bottom tier, those bottom two or three income levels, so disproportionately to the rest of the state, as opposed to an average look. It's important stuff. So yeah,
Can I just add a point? I think I was present at the creation in terms of the EDDs. CROG tried to get an economic development district done, and we were spanked and sent away. So I was there. I can name names if you like. Yeah. The other thing is, I think there's two different issues here. One is the ability to respond to opportunities. And again, the federal money is an example where we don't respond to all the opportunities. Again, in my previous life in the Midwest, I had four staff combing federal regulations and elsewhere, and a federal lobbyist looking for opportunities. And then we had the capacity to follow through with grant writing. We don't, a lot of times, many of our towns and our regions don't have that kind of horsepower. So I think it's an issue of, you know, the capacity to respond to this new era of federal competitive money. I think that's one aspect. The other aspect, as John mentioned, is information, having good information on things like tax incidents or other elements of this. So they're different issues, but the capacity to respond, I mean, our region with two in Massachusetts has retained a federal lobbyist, Chris Giglio, who's the lobbyist for the International City Management Association. And again, every week we have a meeting and we get a whole bunch of stuff that I don't otherwise see. You know, we have someone on the ground in Washington and he gives us stuff every week. And that's one piece of the puzzle. The other part of the puzzle is having the horsepower to respond to write the grants. And again, as John knows, with respect to the EDA grants, I mean, CROG was on the ground helping with staffing to help get that done. But most of our fellow councils and governments don't have that kind of horsepower. So I think this is very important, but I think there's two issues. One is the information, and then the second is capacity to respond to opportunities, because we're going to have, 5 years of opportunities on federal money. And if we don't respond, let me tell you a quick story. When I first came here, George W. Bush was trying to rescind a federal program for case management for multi-problem families, which is many times you have families that have five social workers working on different issues in the family, you know, mom, dad, and the kids. And he was going to rescind this in his budget. And of course, where I was, people were up in arms and flying to Washington and, fighting this issue because it was a much better way of dealing with things with a single case manager to manage this. I came here and I talked to the commissioner of DSS and said, how are you approaching this? He said, oh, we never even applied for the grant to do it. In other words, we missed the boat sometimes. We just don't have the horsepower.
Yeah.
And so I think there's two things, the informational side of it. How are we going to respond not only to the federal opportunities, but just generally, both in knowing about it and then acting on it? I think that's a very important issue. So I would support the direction.
Yeah, and if it's a question of staffing, keep in mind, we, thanks to the work of this group, we have a funding source that yep. COGS and RESTS can take advantage of to help pay for that kind of staffing on behalf
yes.
of
the county. Yep. And it is, I mean, it's a lot of work. You know, prospecting for federal grants and then following through. Many times you have to hire contractors because, as you probably all know, you know, many particular grant agencies have, you know, magic words and formats they like. And if you don't provide the magic words in the format they like, you're, you know, tossed out. So it's not an easy thing, but it's certainly a lot better than watching the boat go by on the river when we're not in it. But
yeah, exactly. John?
Just ought to mention one other issue that has come up, and I've been working with planning and development. They're going to come out with legislation to put forth two pilots based that are COG based to do building regional building officials. Still working through the details of the legislation, but part of that would be to eliminate the statute that requires a 4-year appointment of that position, which has been a hindrance to shared building officials and regional building officials. So we'll see what happens with that, to try it as a pilot with an oversight group watching out to see how it works and what can be done to improve, or et cetera, including training.
Right.
John, question on that specific matter, very exciting. Would that allow greater specialization of building officials for, well, say, different building techniques?
You know, that's something I brought up and pointed several of the people to the Franklin County COG in Massachusetts, which has had a building inspection program for more than 25 years. And that's all set up with specialized inspectors. I think that's the model that people should follow, because it's one that works. So I think that would be a value added to the communities if it was not the sort of the classic, you know, generalist, and we did have the specialties.
Yeah, I think that's going to become increasingly important as we look at new building products and technologies, and also more complex, perhaps environmentally engineered buildings, tighter building envelopes. There's a lot more that can go wrong and a lot more that has to be inspected that may be beyond a generalist ability.
Yep. And John, is the discussion, I mean, I'm sorry to keep harping on this, but is part of the discussion that pilot to perhaps use the RPIP money to help fund it at a COG?
Yes, it is.
Excellent. There you go.
That's exactly where I pointed them to, and in the language I've drafted, it also allows that to be tapped for it's the way it's written now. Hopefully it comes out. It would be a 2-year grant so that the some of the capital needs and the personnel needs could be funded through that program for the 2-year period.
Excellent. Good stuff. Stuff.
Yeah, I was just going to say, one of the other issues is
$250,000 per COG is the number I put on it.
Yep. Sometimes, though, we need critical mass, and that's, you know, why we need regional approaches, which is you have a large enough operation to provide specialization. And again, my harping issue on this is 911 services. If you have two people in the basement, you can't have a Spanish speaker and a domestic crisis specialist and, because you just don't have enough people. Nor can you provide a lot of regular training, because if one person is gone, the other one is there, and so on. But, you know, these are the kinds of things we need to get into, of the critical mass to be able to respond to opportunities and also specialize. I don't know if you remember this, but several years ago, there was a suburban neighborhood or suburban community that was given a warning that there was some gang activity going on in that community, and nobody knew what they were talking about in the dispatch center. They had no clue. And, you know, like 6 or 7 hours later, there was a critical incident, and they had a 6 or 7 hour warning there was something going on, but they didn't understand what was being talked about. So specialization, I think, is when you have that kind of critical mass, you can do more. And the same thing with building inspection and other things. So just something, a footnote.
Thank you. All right. Well, so I think among us, we can perhaps craft a concept for the full ACIR to consider and perhaps agree to move on through the LGF subcommittee. So we'll I guess, communicate among ourselves about putting that together. And if anybody else wants to join on, obviously feel free. So, great. Well, that's really helpful. Are there any other thoughts or comments? If not, I'll just remind everyone that our full ACIR meeting is a week from Friday on the 4th of March. Our next subcommittee, as I said, would be the March 22nd date for Jim's purposes in getting Commissioner Bergeron. If there's nothing else, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Motion seconded by Jim. Those in favor, aye.
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 All right. Thanks, you all. We have work to do. We'll see you soon.
Be well.
Thanks. Thank you.